If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 543, Getting Clear, which is to say, clarifying my position, not whatever the Scientologists mean when they use that phrase, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Thursday, May 9th, 2019. So, in recent podcasts, really, it started off in an episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. I was talking with Robert Brown, a longtime Sea Realm listener and supporter, and somebody who has, you know, followed the peak oil narrative as I have for as long, if not longer, than I have. In a conversation with him that was in the vault, it just sort of came to me unbidden, just as a sort of an unloading of long-held, not just skepticism, but almost resentment over the grip that the peak oil narrative had on my life for some very critical years. An obsession which, I have to say, you know, speaking personally, just from my own life and the disintegration of my family and the career trajectory that I have traced out over the past decade plus, I think the peak oil obsession has demonstrably harmed me. And so, from that moment on, I started to more openly articulate why I am dissatisfied with the peak oil narrative and why I regret having taken it so seriously for so long. So, a little bit of background. When I was at university, I was studying philosophy as an undergrad. And then after I graduated, I went to grad school and I continued my studies in philosophy. And specifically, I was studying the philosophy of science and the philosophy of mind. And in the 1990s, if you were studying the philosophy of mind, unless you were, you know, hopelessly caught up in some European, obscurantism, it made good sense to look to the longtime struggle to create artificial general intelligence. To get an idea of, you know, what it is, what goes into making up a mind. What is thought? What is a belief? What is sensation? How much information does a mind need in order to create a representation of the world around it and to weigh possible future implications of choices made in the present? Because everything connects to everything else, potentially, all information is relevant. So at what point does a thinking system stop gathering information and start making decisions? In the philosophy of mind, this is called the frame problem. At the time, I had not read Ray Kurzweil, but I had read the authors that he was riffing on, people like Marvin Minsky and Hans Moravec. And I was well aware of what both Terence McKenna and Ray Kurzweil would identify as a process whereby information and the accumulation of novelty accelerates over time. I don't remember exactly when I first encountered the concept of Moore's Law, but it was surely sometime in the mid-90s. And I think at the time it would have been fair to call me a techno-utopian. I don't remember when I first encountered the term technological singularity, but I had been familiar with the idea of a rapid transformation of the human experience and the human place in the terrestrial ecosystem since I was a freshman in high school, and I read the short story, which would later be expanded into a novel by Greg Bear called Blood Music, which describes a biotech singularity, which basically starts within the body of a particular researcher who created smart individual cells, got fired from his job, and injected them into his body in order to smuggle them out of the lab. So in the mid-90s, as I was studying the philosophy of mind and thinking a lot about, you know, the decades-long failed attempts to create artificial general intelligence, and also thinking about the rapid evolution of technology and the accumulation of what Terence McKenna would call novelty, I had a very, very different worldview than I did when I started to take peak oil seriously. And when I first heard about peak oil, the thing that made me take it seriously was the short prediction horizon. I saw that information technology was on a particular trajectory, and that it was aimed in a direction that, after a certain point, would radically change our lives and definitely demand our serious consideration and attention. But the peak oil folks, you know, when I first encountered the peak oil narrative and took it seriously in 2007, the peak oil folks were saying, look, we passed peak production back in 2005 and Seneca's Cliff is, you know, months, if not days away. And I took that seriously. And it was only that short predictive horizon which caused me to reject my long-standing thinking about the evolution of technology and the increasing pace at which that evolution takes place. So flash forward 13 years. Oil production has soared to new heights. And I know that people who are serious about peak oil are not impressed. They say that the lateral drilling and slick water techniques called fracking that have allowed oil companies to continue to produce this resource are basically a last-ditch attempt to sustain the unsustainable. The word innovation is a dirty word in peak oil circles. I remember reading online discussions between people who were saying that they didn't take the peak oil doom narrative seriously because of the rapid transformation that information technology is having and will continue to have on our economy and on the way we inhabit the landscape, as Jim Kunstler would say. And the peak oil faithful responded with, "How is computer technology going to continue to advance when the electricity grid is down? When there is no gas to get you from your home to your lab? How can you continue to do this work when civilization, you know, the technological basis for civilization has completely collapsed?" Well, you know what? Have a look around. It hasn't collapsed. If you don't have access to electricity, you're not hearing my voice. And here we are 13 years later. 13 years is nothing in geological time. It's nothing on an evolutionary timescale. But in terms of the advancement of computer technology, 13 years is forever. And if I had thought back in 2008 that 2019 would look like anything, you know, more advanced than the 19th century, well, I never would have taken peak oil seriously. Because information technology was moving fast then, it's moving fast now. And I think that in the near term, the changes that information technology and its capitalist applications will make in our lives, our lived experience, I think that will have a far greater impact on our lived experience than will peak oil. Yes, oil is a finite resource. There will come a time when it costs more energy to get it out of the ground than we get from it. But that doesn't mean that the only path forward from that moment is absolute collapse and reversion to a pre-technological society. And by pre-technological, I suppose I should say pre-electrification civilization. So I know some of you are hearing this and you remain in the peak oil camp and you are upset with me for articulating this point of view. And you're probably leaping to the conclusion that if I've rejected peak oil, that I must have gone over to the far extreme end of the spectrum and now embrace techno-utopianism again. And that's simply not the case. And so that's why this episode is called Getting Clear. I'm going to try to make this point again, because I know that for people who have been caught up in the peak oil mindset, it is one that is difficult to understand and accept. Now, I won't make the common mistake that I encounter, which is thinking that if you don't agree with me, you don't understand what I've said. I'm certainly open to the idea that you can fully understand my argument and not be convinced by it. But all that being said, I want to share with you a correspondence that I had with Jim, your ad attacker in Seattle, the creator of the Attack Ads podcast. There is an exclamation point in Attack Ads. It is an imperative statement. Do this. So after the release of the conversation with Jim Kunstler, where I shared with Jim my disillusionment with the peak oil narrative, Jim, your ad attacker, not Jim Kunstler, sent me the following email. He wrote,
"Hey, KMO. Thought I would put some thoughts to you, since you so thoughtfully inspired them, on your seeming rejection of the peak oil narrative's lack of development over the years, your getting PO'd at PO. I'm starting to get what you're saying. Yes, there are those that reject salvation through technical innovation because collapse! And damn, think they, if my life doesn't change from the current shit show of dulldom, I'm going to get really upset. That's reminiscent to me of John Michael Greer's Apocalypse Not narrative. Ever wonder why the end of the world is always within the lifetime of the doom prophet? But your friend Doug had it best so far. What is there to change in the narrative other than the conclusions? Energy return on investment. Are we all gonna die? Well, no. But will our toys be as shiny or our food as cheap? After a few decades of instability, will there be as many mouths to stuff? Me? During the 1970s gas crunch, I developed a worldview I've seen articulated seldom, which I thought I'd share, that kind of dovetails. For me, technological innovation should do just one thing. It should insert function better, but with less input, be that input, fuel, time, effort, whatever. If it doesn't, it isn't an innovation. It's merely an exercise in doing something differently. In the 1970s, for example, it used to cost 2 gallons of gas to squeeze out a dollar of economic output, roughly. 10 years later, according to the later census, that ratio changed to 1 to 1. The United States doubled the energy efficiency of its economy in 10 years. A few things have changed from the 1970s. A big one, the caps on gas prices was pulled under, if I remember correctly, Reagan. Prior to that, everyone on the oil supply chain had maximum prices they could charge, even in the face of extreme scarcity, which meant that stations ran out of fuel before the demand for that fuel was met. Hence, the iconic long lines and the license plate rationing that followed. Today, without those caps, the limiting factor is price. And one glance says, yikes, compared to only a decade ago. We've gotten pretty used to the post-peak price. So used to it that we, here I'm referring to the we of the blather sphere, those professionals who are called upon to offer observations for hire, kinda glean over the changes we've made in our lives necessary to higher fuel price adaptations. For example, re-urbanization? Oh, those kids and retirees. So retro. Such gumption. I hear nary a peep about the cost of suburban commutes, let alone of those who can no longer meet those costs. Gee, how many of the current homeless population fall under that failure metric? Before charging into the Podscape with attack ads, I thought about a cast devoted to the concept I promoted in a LiveJournal community I hosted called Home Effonomic, a portmanteau for Home Efficiency Economics. This was me attempting to distill my philosophy into words that can be shared. Topics for consideration needed to apply a change to a typical task, be it heating, cooling, cooking, washing, cleaning, what have you, in such a way that minimally impacted the task itself and saved money over a defined period. One participant kludged together a toilet flush system that used rainwater after his village jacked both his water and sewer rates. I got as far at that same project as spreadsheeting the projected cost increases and buying some hardware. Unlike that dude, I didn't have a basement for installation, and a hard freeze convinced me my outdoor system would die a horrible, expensive death in the next deep freeze. Also, since my rates didn't spike, my incentive was not nearly so imperative. Okay, back to your peak oil objections, and, interestingly, your regret over not focusing on newer tech in the meantime. I have to say, yeah, smartphones and the like have made life interesting, but are they worth the hype the folks like Wired give them? Nah. Very few do more than addict those prone to flashy lights and blinging bells and whistles. As you were saying to Scott in CROM Vault 327, editing video on them just blows, and audio and video? Forget about it. I'm with Kevin, the Lummi Islander who wrote you and got quoted in CROM Vault 326. Hyperconnectivity has not led to hyper-happy-happy. Whether we will all freaking starve when the next supply line constraint from peak oil hits remains to be seen. Perhaps held in the right pause, such hyperconnectivity and computational power can help move food about, or at least help less go to waste when supply is limited. That, at least, is beyond my clumsy thumb jamming on smeary screens. I've strained your eyeballs enough for now. Probably too much to just quote anyway. Later, Jim.
So Jim's email reached me on March 12th, 2019. The next day, I wrote back. I wrote, "Hi, Jim," and then quoted the following sentence from his email. Quote, "I have to say, yeah. Smartphones and the like have made life interesting. But are they worth the hype folks like Wired give them? Nah." Close quote. To which I responded, "Remember the podcast you did about smart TVs and how they are designed to collect data on the user and send it to the manufacturer? The television as surveillance device is a quaint notion compared to the smartphone. The TV sits in a room in your house all day. Working people spend most of their day away from the place where their TV sits waiting for their return, but they take their phones with them to work, to the store, to church, to the gym, to restaurants. Many people take them to bed every night and reach for them immediately upon waking from sleep. Google openly admits that their aim is to get to know each and every one of us so well that we'll never need to do a Google search. Google will know what we're doing, who we're doing it with, what we like, what we fear, what we hope to achieve. They will know us better than we know ourselves, to the point where we'll never have to formulate a search query. Google will know what information we want or need before we do, and they'll serve it up to us unbidden. That's their ambition. And the CIA has got their back. The spooks know that Google is already able to collect information about us that most people would not tolerate if an intelligence agency collected the exact same information. The state is bound by the Constitution. Google is not. And the CIA and their ilk know that they can get whatever information they need from the surveillance companies. And be careful. Most of the peak oil folks who have pushed back against my repudiation of peak oil doomerism don't seem to understand that information technology can pose a hazard. They assume that if I'm talking about a world in which the lights are still on the day after tomorrow, that I must be enthralled with shiny technological distractions. Any deviation from total commitment to doom equals techno-utopianism. I kind of got that vibe from your smartphones and the like have made life interesting, but comment. It seems I can't be clear enough on this point. What I'm saying is that the surveillance apparatus we feed with our mobile use of social media and location-based services and the power that it gives to elites is a bigger deal in the short term than petroleum supply constraints. Do you really disagree with that? My objection is to the focus on short-term doom in the peak oil community. I was thoroughly embedded in that community. I witnessed and participated in rampant doom mongering. That vision has not been borne out by subsequent developments. Can you say the same about surveillance capitalism? And then I close by linking to an interview between Naomi Klein and Shoshana Zuboff. Jim wrote back.
Whoa, dude. I wholeheartedly agree with everything. Taking a cue from Zeynep Tufekci, Tristan Harris, the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower Christopher Wiley, Sarah Wachter-Bechter, David Daly, and a raft more would be a course I endorse with gusto. Hell, it's kind of the course I'm taking myself, as you note. All of those names have been invaluable sources for past episodes of mine. Thing is, in the latest of your position staking, your focus seemed to have only been on throwing up your hands at the PO doomosphere, not getting into the weeds of surveillance tech and the consequences. I know you've discussed those concerns before, but the latest talk? Not so much, at least in the audio. I confess I don't dip much of a toe in the daily YouTube confessionals. I, stupidly, combined that with your repeated admission of Wired, which I haven't read in years, which tended to the techno-utopian, and I completely misread your take. Oh, and let's not discount the misleadingness of your having a shit river surveillance can in your place. I'm frankly surprised you leave that thing plugged in when recording interviews. I'm not saying it is a clear violation of confidentiality, but I don't think anyone can say it isn't, or at least might not be perceived by a guest as one. As an aside, the wife sees a shrink dealing with chronic illness pressures mostly, but hey, probably with me as well. While in a session, a medical therapy session, Alexa chimed in with, "I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that." The wife didn't know the damn thing existed, let alone was listening. In her defense, the doc has unplugged it since, and presumably with other patients as well. That is an unknown can of whoop-ass, potentially violating confidentiality with a talkie bug. End aside. I think if you had led more directly with, for example, Jim Kunstler about your concerns about this new tech, and tie that into the doomer insistence that industrial civilization is all about just decline without a glimmer of development, I know it's something you've mentioned before, come to think of it. Yeah, I'm thick. I have been collecting lots of info on smartphones for just such a series of episodes myself, with exactly the same focus and threat assessment. My latest series on the emergent history of advertising, a la Tim Wu, was a divergence from the smartphone path. Besides, it's still so emergent, it's hard to follow developments and go to work, fix up the house, blah, blah, blah. Thanks for clearing up my stupid, and I look forward to your new path of inquiry. Later, Jim.
Again, that email came on March 13th. Now, here we are, a month and a half later, and I just got a letter in the mail from Jim, something that he sends about this time every year with a generous donation. And as much as I appreciate the donation, I think I appreciate receiving an actual letter more. In my youth, and by youth I mean my late teens and my 20s, email existed, but I didn't have any interaction with it. But I had good friends, one friend in particular I'm thinking of, who moved away. And we kept in touch by writing letters. Then I spent a year in Japan, and letters from home were like manna from heaven. They were wonderful. It was such a glorious experience to receive a letter in the mail, to look at the envelope, to see the familiar handwriting of a family member or friend. Email does not compare. But the volume of correspondence that we exchange now, it dwarfs the volume of correspondence that we exchanged in the 80s and 90s by sending pieces of paper around. But with the massive increase in quantity has come a diminution of the quality, not only of the quality of the writing and the thought that people put into correspondence, but just also the quality of the experience of receiving such a communication. That's my long-winded way of saying that a letter is worth 1,000 emails. And I probably get several thousand emails for every actual letter that I receive via post. But on April 30th, Jim put the following into an actual letter. He writes, "Hey again, KMO. Now that the paycheck has been deposited, the slip of enclosed paper should re-up my Vault membership nicely, I think. Think of the gratis added as kudos for maintaining your high standard of providing interesting content in this podcasting gig. What I know firsthand to be a difficult task. At least in my case, a difficult attempt, not necessarily execution. Case in point, I think your newly declared focus on electronic agents of surveillance and gefuckening, TM, currently being deployed against us, the so-called users, to be timely and welcome." There's an asterisk there. And he cashes out the asterisk at the bottom of the page by writing, "I do apologize for jumping on the premature WTF bandwagon with my email. Feel free to mine it for content should you see any entertaining way to do so. Hell, drop a line and I'll record myself reading that part of the correspondence. At least the relevant portions. Should you want to do exactly that." And Jim concludes with, "As you pointed out, this is exactly the stuff I stumbled upon as content myself, though from a different direction. The more voices shouting this shit, the better. Cheers, Jim, your ad attacker." And now to carry on the conversation, I have on the line, Jim, your ad.
Glad to be back.
Hey, Jim, you know what? What grand corporate event is happening today?
I don't know. Tell me, please.
Uber is raising about $80 billion with their initial public offering.
Oh, God.
Yep.
I think my skin just crawled.
And they're still losing money on every ride, but they've made no secret of their intention to cut the expensive drivers out of the loop as soon as possible.
And given how much they're actually paying those expensive drivers, that is really saying something. Because they're not paying them well at all.
No, they're not.
What is the purpose of a ride-hailing service? Is it to create employment and move people economically, or is it to generate a return for investors?
I believe the second one might apply since they have an initial public offering going. And really, the ride sharing is nothing more than a way of getting around local taxicab laws, which were passed to prevent past practices, such as people giving someone a ride and not actually taking them to the destination, but rather to the Pine Barrens and dumping them in a shallow grave. Or take some kind of advantage. Absolutely. I mean, there are reasons we had these laws that Uber and others are trying to get around.
But are the reasons for those laws eternal, or did they apply to a particular moment in time?
Oh, please. Only the laws of physics are eternal. Everything else can be just made up on the fly. That's why they call it a legal fiction. It may be fiction. It may be something we made up. But we're going to listen to it because it's still a good idea. You can't do that with physics. You can't make turn lead into gold without, you know, a supernova.
Yep.
So we don't try to violate those laws, hopefully. But yeah, everything else is on the table for consideration, perhaps renewal.
Or perhaps radical revision.
Yes, radical revision. Yes. Cut it with a machete. See what comes out the other side.
Well, speaking of radical revisions, I have made a public declaration about a change in my own worldview, and that's what sparked the email correspondence that we read out to the listeners.
And I would say I am revising my opinion greatly. I still think that if I had been right about your opinion, I would not be in any way revising a thing. But what you provided me was new information, or at least clear information that I was wrong about my assumption about what you were saying. So on that, I offer my apology.
But you are a careful listener and note taker. So if you jump to the wrong conclusion, then it's likely many other people did as well.
And if I remember correctly, you put a few of those other people on the show.
Yeah, that I did.
I believe Kevin from Lummi Island was one. You talked to your friend Rob. And I think we all had the same message. Dude, what's up?
Yep. And the one person, two people, I suppose, who are not really persuaded by additional information were Jim Kunstler himself and my friend Doug, who lives here in Bellows Falls.
You know, I'm not sure that Jim Kunstler wouldn't. Because, again, the only thing I've heard of you was your recording with Jim. And that recording was the basis of my letter. Along with your friend Doug. So Jim and Doug may have the same information as I did.
No, Doug's got a lot more information for sure.
Oh, okay. That's true. He's just around the corner or something, right?
Yes.
Walkable neighborhoods. You got to love them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I walked out to get my Mother's Day card that I told you about before we actually got started in the proper conversation.
Yeah, whereas if I wanted to walk to get my Mother's Day card, it would be... It would be a long walk. Let's just put it that way. And I've got a pretty walkable neighborhood, but, you know, we still have zoning laws that say I can't go around the corner to a store. It's supposed to be a house.
Right. Well, hey, let's talk about automation and the capture of behavioral surplus.
Excellent.
So I guess I'll start, and you, whenever I hit something that you want to take in a different direction or expand on, let me know.
Cool.
So, where to start? Let's start on September 11th, 2001.
Ah, yes. We remember it well.
Yeah. Seems like a different world.
That's because it was.
Yep. My kids, you know, my oldest son was less than a year old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, he has no memory of it, and his brother was yet to be born. So, you know, mm-hmm. from my kids' perspective, the pre-9/11 era, it's, you know, like the Renaissance or the Gilded Age or, you know, mm-hmm. the Age of Discovery. I mean, it's something that happened way back, but it doesn't have much to do with current reality.
Right. It would be like the Tet Offensive for you and I.
Exactly. Exactly. I have no particular issue with the Tet Offensive or with anybody's response to it.
Right. I have no opinion at all. It happened on the news, and that was interrupting my Sesame Street time. That's all I remember.
Yeah. But for folks like you and me, you know, who would fly on airplanes before September 11th and after, boy, there's a big difference there.
Oh, yeah. We used to smuggle magnets in our pockets as kids just so we could set off the alarms. And now, you know, you'll get a very personal search if the alarm goes off and they're not satisfied.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes, indeed.
Yeah, kids today, man, I feel sorry for them because flying now sucks. I mean, it's so bad that I don't know why people even endure it, why they put up with it. But it used to be fun. Flying used to be a blast. Now, no, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just flew to Texas and back, and saved me many, many, many miles, you know, driving in my truck, a truck that I wouldn't really trust to take me to Texas and back. So, you know, there's...
But that's for your job, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's for your job. So, yeah, we suck things up for our jobs that we just wouldn't do otherwise. So I think we all agree on that.
Yeah, absolutely. But after September...
So I'm going to break in here for just a second and share a little something that I found online. I've been trying to find in Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, the portion of the book where she describes what was going on behind the scenes at Google in the aftermath of 9/11. And I have not found that. I really do need to refresh my memory on the details there. Something that I started to share with Jim and then realized I didn't really have the details at the ready. And as I say, it's a very long book, and I just have an electronic copy of it, you know, a Kindle copy. It's a legit copy. And just searching through the book, I haven't really found the bit that I was looking for. But I did find something that is relevant, and I think worth sharing here. This is from an article on lawreviewofbooks.org. It is an article about Shoshana Zuboff's book, and it's called Thieves of Experience, How Google and Facebook Corrupted Capitalism. And it starts off, I'm just going to have to jump in here sort of in the middle. It's describing what's called, what Shoshana Zuboff in her book calls click wrap, which are the terms of service agreements that we agree to all the time. We do it without even thinking now. We just click that little box. I agree to the terms. Okay, give me the good stuff. What we're doing there is entering into a legal contract. A contract that binds us, a contract that makes enforceable claims upon us, that we agree to without even reading the contract. And it is understood that nobody is going to read these contracts, but their legitimacy has been upheld in courts. So the block quote that I want to share with you begins with, "Consider the terms of service agreements that govern the division of rights and the delegation of ownership online. Non-negotiable, subject to emendation, which is to say editing, and extension at the company's whim, and requiring only a casual click to bind the user, TOS agreements are parodies of contracts, yet they have been granted legal legitimacy by the courts. Law professors," writes Zuboff, quote, "call these contracts of adhesion because they impose take-it-or-leave-it conditions on users that stick to them whether they like it or not," close quote. Fundamentally undemocratic, the ubiquitous agreements help Google and other firms commandeer personal data as if by fiat. The bullying style of TOS agreements also characterizes the practice common to Google and other technology companies of threatening users with a loss of functionality should they try to opt out of data sharing protocols or otherwise attempt to escape surveillance. Anyone who tries to remove a pre-installed Google app from an Android phone, for instance, will likely be confronted by a vague but menacing warning. If you disable this app, other apps may no longer function as intended. This is a coy, high-tech form of blackmail. Give us your data or the phone dies. In pulling off its data grab, Google also benefited from the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. As much as the dot-com crash, the horrors of 9/11 set the stage for the rise of surveillance capitalism. Zuboff notes that in 2000, members of the Federal Trade Commission, frustrated by internet companies' lack of progress in adopting privacy protections, began formulating legislation to secure people's control over their online information and severely restrict the company's ability to collect and store it. It seemed obvious to the regulators that ownership of personal data should, by default, lie in the hands of private citizens, not corporations. The 9/11 attacks changed the calculus. The centralized collection and analysis of online data on a vast scale came to be seen as essential to national security. The privacy provisions debated just months earlier vanished from the conversation more or less overnight, Zuboff writes. Google and other Silicon Valley companies benefited directly from the government's new stress on digital surveillance. They earned millions through contracts to share their data collection and analysis techniques with the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency. But they also benefited indirectly. Online surveillance came to be viewed as normal and even necessary by politicians, government bureaucrats, and the general public. One of the unintended consequences of this uniquely distressing moment in American history, Zuboff observes, was that, quote, the fledgling practices of surveillance capitalism were allowed to root and grow with little regulatory or legislative challenge, close quote. Other possible ways of organizing online markets, such as through paid subscriptions for apps and services, never even got a chance to be tested.
You're listening to the C Realm podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. But after September 11th, I'm not sure if it was Brin and Page or if it was Eric Schmidt, but one of them got it into their head that basically they were going to solve America's security problems by carrying out their mission statement, which is to organize the world's data and make it useful. You know, and in this instance, make it useful for people looking to keep the nation safe. And
okay.
They had great support, both moral support and institutional support and financial support from the three-letter agencies like the NSA and the CIA, because the three-letter agencies know that a company like Google, just in the pursuit of profit, which is enshrined and, you know, it's a motivation that cannot be criticized in the United States, they will manage to collect data on all of us that we would not tolerate the NSA or the CIA collecting directly. But the three-letter agencies have known from the beginning that they can get whatever they want from the surveillance companies, you know, Google being the surveillance company, the primary one, but many others have discovered their business model and followed in their footsteps at this point. So they provided what, you know, path clearing they could to help out this organization. And it turns out that things like Google Maps and Google Earth, these are things that started off in the realm of the deep state. These were plans, these were systems, these were technologies that have been surveillance-based and aimed at social control from their inception.
Now you're referring here to, is it Yasha Levine's book, Surveillance Valley?
You know, I took in four books on the same topic in rapid succession and I'm having trouble keeping them apart. But yeah, this sounds pretty much like Surveillance Valley.
Yeah, I picked that one up and I got to the high hundreds before I had to take it back to the library. Somebody else was waiting for it. And it took me so long to get through it just because I was taking so many notes.
Well, what stands out for you from that book?
Exactly. It's like, wow, this is a target-rich environment. I'm pretty much going to copy the book on my typewriter or my keyboard. And I was just shocked at how the ARPANET went from a way of organizing IBM punch cards about people in Thailand to let's take the same thing and apply it to ghetto America. At that time, it was called ghetto America. It was just lifted the technology, placed it down someplace else with some adaptation for the local culture. And in fact, I remember reading, I took this note. I need to call this up. This was a note on Project Cambridge, which was an ARPANET thing that was happening at MIT and Harvard. And there was a lot of protest about these things at the time from the kids going to school there. They did not like this stuff. So one professor is responding to this protest, and he suggested that whenever a professor used the system, this thing that was housed, I believe, in just off MIT, but all the professors could gain access to it for their research, that they publish and make public the results. One professor who was very much in line with the three-letter agencies and the work that he was doing at Harvard or MIT for those agencies wrote a letter to this other guy. He says, quote, the Department of Justice can arrange with you to do some research on how to keep blacks quiet. And when the Cambridge Project has a useful system going, you may utilize that system to do the work you have undertaken. The Cambridge Project will not refuse access to its facilities because it disagrees with your politics. However, if I'm doing some work on how to make blacks noisy, also using Cambridge Project facilities, you and I individually have control over the decision on whether or not to share our data. That's just the biases, the racial biases, the political biases, they're not hidden. And that was a letter from September 30th of 1969 that the author found, that Levine found in the archives of MIT. And he backed up that kind of thing with a whole bunch of other stuff.
In that period, 999 people out of 1,000 had nothing to do with a computer.
That's
never
right.
Touched one, never had anything to do with it. And so when students were protesting against the Vietnam War, they just lumped in computer systems with, you know, things that the government and the military did. And there was no YouTube, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, there was nothing to make the internet feel like it belongs to there. You know, there was no internet, but there was
nothing.
Computer networking and computer technology make it feel like it belongs to us, the people. It was strictly something that the powerful used. And, you know, so their attitudes toward it was, you know, this is a tool of oppression. We object to its use. And that has completely, completely been defeated. I mean, now the internet, or so it seems, belongs to us, and all the sites and all the companies are striving to give us great things for free that will fill our hours with bliss and laughter. You know, it doesn't, of course. It makes us sort of slack-jawed and glassy-eyed and agitated. But the narrative battle has been thoroughly won, so that a book like Yasha Levine's, or I think with the September 11th stuff, I was mostly reaching back into Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. But now books that champion the viewpoint of the students about computers from the 1960s and early 70s, now that's a counter-narrative. You know, that's an underground sort of subversive narrative. And the main narrative is the world is being transformed in a most wonderful way by computer networks and artificial intelligence.
I was shocked not just by what you were saying, but also the protests. They were against the computers, but they were also very specifically, according to Levine's book, against the use these computers were put to. They were objecting to the fact that these computers were helping the war effort. They were specifically there to confront or to engage in counterinsurgency. Some of them were engaged in other, I don't remember everything that they did with these computers, but a big one was trying to catalog people in order to reach them, in order to pacify them. And I would like to throw one more thing in there. You're right about Google going all out about cataloging the web, but just after September 11th, one of the big grocery chains took all of its buyer information through its little, what do you call them, the loyalty cards, and sent that to the Justice Department in the hopes that they could use it to find terrorists. So the notion that it's only online that you're going to find this mass data logging is not true at all. These loyalty cards were a precursor to all the stuff that Google and Facebook and all those guys do. And even before then, back when we were in college, we learned that for a certain amount of money, you plunk down a large amount of money, you can get an area's purchasing records for an hour. So all of the purchases that go through a chain in 1 hour or 2 hour or 3 hour blocks, that way you can test the promotional work that you've done, the commercials that you run. And this was back in the 70s and 80s. So mining for it has only gotten better, but it's by no means something that was born of the internet.
I'd like to... I don't know if it's fast forwarding or rewinding, because, you know, it's back from now, but forward from 2011. But during the Obama administration, there was a hot minute where people were concerned with the Obama administration's intention to collect a lot of metadata, you know, that is generated by people making phone calls, sending emails, moving around, that sort of thing. And I remember the president himself assuring us that, look, this isn't personal. This isn't identifiable. This is just the metadata. This is not your name. This is not your phone number. But it is trivially easy to take metadata and connect it to the movements and the communications of actual people, specific people.
Well, I did he actually say that it isn't your name or your phone number? Or was he just talking about we're not listening on the calls?
He was very specific about it. They're just collecting metadata. And
well,
go ahead.
I thought that the metadata was this telephone called this telephone from that was located by this repeater at this time.
Yes.
The call lasted this long.
Phone numbers would be included, yeah.
Let me repeat what I said when this story first broke. This program does not involve the content of phone calls or the names of people making calls. Instead, it provides a record of phone numbers and the times and lengths of calls. Metadata that can be queried if and when we have a reasonable suspicion that a particular number is linked to a terrorist organization.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, all you have to do is get the, I don't know, digital equivalent of a phone book to figure out who was using that phone or who used that phone normally.
So I think how to parse this. The world has changed pretty dramatically from the time, between the time I started the CROM podcast and now. And we being, psychedelic, silly people, were half expecting something big to go down on December 21st, 2012. And as far as anybody can tell, nothing did. But 2012 was a big year. That was a year when there was an announcement, a paper published about, a breakthrough in machine learning that involved neural networks and what's now called deep learning. And it is the implementation of that 2012 breakthrough over the past half decade, which has made it seem like we're in the midst of an AI revolution. When in fact, in terms of research, not all that much has happened since 2012, but in terms of implementing what was discovered, we're still in that implementation phase. And that's why we're getting, one, all of these, seemingly super smart products like Google Translate. They updated it one night and it got really demonstrably better overnight. And
okay.
I've turned off Alexa, partly in response to your concerns and partly so that I can mention her name without her coming on and asking what she can do for me.
But that is irritating, by the way.
But, now, remember in the 90s, Apple came out with the Newton and it was supposed to be a handwriting interface and the handwriting recognition was so bad that it was utterly useless. And
it wasn't utterly useless. I do remember it occasionally recognized a letter.
Exactly. But, to occasionally recognize a letter is to be utterly useless if that is your primary means of communicating via the device.
Fine.
The Amazon Echo, it understands my spoken speech and I don't have to, make an effort to be clear or to enunciate crisply. I can mm-hmm. be walking away from it, have my back turned to it. I have actually two of them in the house because one of them had a problem and Amazon just sent me a newer version. If I'm speaking, the two of them work out between themselves, which one I'm talking to, and only one of them responds.
Now, do you have the kind that has the little light on top that zooms in on the source of the sound?
I don't know what that is. I mean, I see a light come on when I say the wake word and it's telling me it's listening.
Right. It's a little light on the top, but if you have to have more than one person in the room, I think. It's like when you ask Alexa, the little light will swivel to point toward the source of the sound. So it not only knows that you're talking to it, it knows where you are in the room.
I've had the thing like a year and a half now, and when I first got it, I would say, Alexa, who am I? And she would say, I don't know who's speaking, but you're in KMO's account. And now when I say, Alexa, who am I? She says, you're KMO.
Okay.
The device, it's the same device sitting on the shelf, but, the programming has been updated.
I don't know anything about these things. I don't know how much of the stuff is going online to Amazon headquarters where it's just telling the can what to say and how much of it is internal to the thing that needs to have firmware updated.
It's all in the cloud.
That's what I figured. So, yeah, they come out with software upgrades, and suddenly you're not just somebody breaking into KMO's apartment. You're KMO.
Well, it's actually gone the other way. When I first got the device, somebody could have broken in here and, you know, maybe ordered something from Amazon on my dime.
Right.
But now the device recognizes my voice.
Which, if you, you know, have an Amazon account linked to that darn thing, is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And I've been buying stuff on Amazon.com since 1995, I think.
Well, you also had some background there, right?
Well, even before I worked for them, I had made a couple purchases and written a couple of reviews.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm still surprised you have that. I mean, please, don't let anybody tell you what to buy and what not to buy. But I go over to a friend's house, and that's my encounter with the Alexa can, and it just drives me nuts. They love it. They will sometimes say that, or if they're in the wrong room, they'll pick out their cell phone and they'll talk to Siri. I don't have any of that activated on my cell phone. I don't want it. It creeps me out. And maybe I would have been one of those guys trying to shut down the computer lab in 68, 69 if I'd been on MIT or Harvard. But I don't know why I don't like it as much as people seem to really dig it. That's maybe a bigger question.
It has a few very convenient uses. I use it to set timers all the time. And you set little alarms and reminders and things like that. And before I got the Amazon Echo, Google's calendar was completely useless to me because as often as not, I would, you know, enter an event on the wrong day. And I would be very careful about punching what I thought was the right day on that grid. And almost always, it was not almost always, but it wasn't right enough to make the device useful. And now it is 100% accurate because I just speak the day, you know, I just say,
okay,
set a calendar reminder, set a calendar event. She'll say when and, you know, what and when, and I'll just speak it. And it's always right where it was never right before. And I despise touchscreen interfaces.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I have big, fat, clumsy fingers myself.
Yeah, so if I'm going to be talking through a machine, I either want to have a full-size keyboard, you know, with moving keys that I can clitter at, or I want to just speak it. I just want to say what, you know, I want to say, and cut out the smartphone, you know, cut out that interface. And I'm happy to say, I think the era of the smartphone will be fairly short-lived, but I think for people like you, that will be bad news, because at least with the smartphone, you know what it is that's counting your steps every day. You know what it is that's tracking your location, you know, and reporting to whatever advertisers or stores are near you. You know, here's somebody who might be up for one of your specials. You know it's centered in the cell phone. But I think the cell phone's going to go away, and we're going to have these voices talking to us all day. They're going to know us very, very well, better than we know ourselves in a lot of instances. And we're not going to know what device is talking to us. We're not going to know whose will it's enacting, you know, what corporation's will it's enacting, or, you know, who it's collecting information on whose behalf is it collecting information about us. It will be running on a cloud server somewhere, but, you know, what does that mean?
Well, if we continue on our current path, you may be absolutely right. I'm sensing backlash. I think it's just starting. I think your decision to take the direction that you have indicated you're taking is one sign of that. There's other signs. You had mentioned that in the letter that I did a special about the smart televisions. Well, one of the things I looked into was this little on the media thing where they interviewed a legislator that came out with a law. It's called the We Are Watching You law. And very simply, if something is reporting any data to anything other than maybe your personal whatever, it has to say, we are watching you. And of course, that went over like the proverbial lead balloon, but it got debated in the halls of Congress. That's not something that would have happened pre-9/11, because it would have been a natural progression. And I think now people are going, wait a minute. I think we're on the brink of maybe challenging the pace of the adaptation. Of course, only if people get involved in helping challenge the pace of the adaptation.
You know, anytime I watch for any length of time members of Congress or senators talking to people who are knowledgeable about technology and demonstrating in the process how utterly clueless they are about technology, I despair that these are the people who are supposed to be protecting our interests, you know, from artificial intelligence-enabled naked capitalism.
Yeah, the Zuckerberg grilling was especially amusing. It's like, how do you make your money? Sell advertisement. And he just stood there looking at the guy like, I'm not calling you an idiot, because in this case I don't have to.
You've just done it yourself.
I'd like to thank you for throwing me a softball. Yeah, I hear you. These the people in Congress are elected because they can speak really well, and not necessarily because they have mad skills on the keyboard. Attorneys and judges, people that often go on to Congress, they dictate into a little tape recorder, and somebody else types up whatever they've dictated. I used to be the guy that typed it up, as I worked as a legal secretary, so I know that fully well. These guys have no interest in learning the internet, and then they get to Congress and the internet's a topic. You're right. Despair is appropriate.
Now, I am wary of unjustified reflexive cynicism. I think it's harmful.
Oh, why do you think that?
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, it's a difficult territory to stake out, you know, that golden position between reflexive nihilism and just unjustified optimism.
And I think I put it out in one of my episodes. Right now, very few people have to worry about the surveillance that they are under. The homeless, they really have to worry. They are being surveilled and being harassed by the police through surveillance. But the average person who actually votes and has an address, so far, we haven't had a big case. We haven't had a Stasi. We haven't lived through surveillance even before our computers and our databases that amazed people by its extremes. If that happens, we may have a Germany moment. We may have a time when the wall comes down and suddenly they realize how bad the surveillance was. By that time, who knows if we'll be able to do anything about it. That's an open question, I think.
So contrasting the Stasi, you know, the East German secret police, with the situation in the U.S. where most of the surveillance that is directed against ordinary citizens is being done, you know, for the purposes of either selling them products or collecting information about them to sell to somebody else who, you know, has some interest in future behavior. And then also comparing that to China. You know, Google,
yes.
Apple, and Amazon know a hell of a lot more about you and me than any Stasi agent knew about anybody in East Berlin. They have a lot more data on us. They have much more accurate, you know, data on our movements and on our activities and probably on our ideologies and our inclinations. But they don't really care about anything that doesn't make them money. In China, they don't even have the same sort of propaganda about the value of individuality and privacy that we have here. You know, here it's largely sort of a feel-good story. It doesn't have a whole lot of interaction with the truth, but at least we have that priority. In China, there is no such priority. And yet the Chinese government seems to be really focused on giving their people a sense of optimism and, you know, selling them the story that China is the rising power and that all of this commerce and all of this technology is going to make everybody richer and happier. And for a lot of people living in China, that's a pretty convincing story because it seems to match up very well with, you know, the course of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a guy.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Oh,
I interviewed a British guy who wrote a book on technology a year or so ago. His name is Callum Chase, and he was saying, you know, I've lived in the UK my whole life, and prior to the 21st century, I never, never saw any Chinese tourists in England, and now they're everywhere. And it's because China, you know, within our lifetimes, tens of millions of people starved to death in China.
Yes.
You know, because the Chinese communist government couldn't really... I think it was a matter of nobody wanting to be the bearer of bad news. So every official along the chain misrepresented the size of harvests. So the Chinese Communist Party thought they had a huge surplus with which they could sell and buy weapons and heavy equipment and stuff. And it turns out they were actually running a deficit, and tens of millions of people starved to death, and the society didn't collapse, and the government didn't fall, which is... It's not the reason why I don't, you know, take the collapse narrative seriously anymore, but I see that as sort of indicative of how unrealistic the idea that we're going to have this cascading failure of critical systems that is going to leave us in a perpetual blackout, and it's going to happen. It's going to be an event that starts one day and never ends. Because, you know, if you go into the poorer parts of the world and you travel around, we would have to fall a very, very long way before we were living like people live in Peru right now. But Peru is stable. You know, their society, it's not great. It's really hard to move money around. It's hard to do a lot of the things that we take for granted here, but there's no notion on anybody's part that the whole system is going to fall apart tomorrow. And they have got so much less than we do. I think we can fall a very, very, very long way, and it will not constitute the sort of collapse that, you know, I lapped up back in 2007, 2008, 2009, when I was really taking that stuff seriously.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
So I'm going to leave off there. That's about the first third of the conversation with Jim. The concluding two-thirds of the conversation can be found in Sea Realm Vault podcast episode number 335, which I plan to get posted tomorrow. And before I go, just want to say, first of all, I mentioned the most recent famine in China, which I said took place during our lifetimes. Now, I'm not sure exactly how old Jim is, but I was born in 1968, and the Great Chinese Famine that accompanied the Great Leap Forward started in 1959 and ended in 1961. So while it's in living memory, not my living memory. Alrighty, well, I'm not going to say a whole lot here at the end of the podcast, other than it's been a while, but I got a communication sometime back from a listener who, you know, noticed that I wasn't putting out these regular free weekly podcasts. They're hardly weekly anymore. And just, I guess, assumed that I was basically just kicking back and taking it easy. And that's just not the case. For this year, the year 2019, I have resolved to upload a YouTube video every single day. My YouTube channel is Out of My Head. It's OUTTAMYHEAD, all one word, Out of My Head. And sometimes they are just, you know, unedited, sort of from the hip, just walk and talk sort of cell phone videos. And sometimes I put more effort into it. But there is something new on YouTube from me every day. And I'm still doing the weekly radio show. Sometimes I'm using archive material for that. But whenever there is a new interview, I put that up as a CROM podcast, a free CROM podcast. But the majority of my podcasting work right now is to be found behind the CROM Vault paywall. I run no ads. There are no Sea Realm ads to attack. But I do have bills to pay. And so while I put out loads of free material, most of my podcasting material these days is to be found in the Sea Realm Vault. And I know, you know, there are Sea Realm Vault subscribers who subscribe for a while, and then they get off, and then they come back, and they catch up on what they missed, and that's absolutely fine. Every little bit helps. But all new subscribers need to come in through Patreon these days. I found that the old way of administering the Sea Realm Vault was just too labor-intensive on my part. So if you would like to subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast, just go to my Patreon page. It's patreon.com/KMO. And also, I do a weekly comic strip. It is called Geb. That is G-E-B-B, or Golf Echo Bravo Bravo. It's about a group of aliens who live underneath the ice in Antarctica, and they'd really like to help us out with some clean energy technology, or maybe some civics help, or maybe some economic advice. Perhaps they could show us how to live prosperously within the ecological limits of this planet and not be so dependent on continuous growth. But such decisions are above their pay grade, so they have to find other ways to occupy their time and attention, and that is what the comic strip is about. I know that most of the people who listen to this podcast have never seen the comic strip, and I'd like to change that. So do check it out. You can find it at geb.io. It's also on Facebook, though I personally am not. All right, that's all for this episode of the Sea Realm Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I will talk to you again soon. And until that time, I hope that you will stay well.